You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rachel Beanland, author of Florence Adler Swims Forever. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. It's Halloween tonight, a distinctly non-Jewish holiday, if ever there was one. Halloween started as All Hallows' Eve, a night of remembrance of the dead prior to All Hallows' Day, one of many Christian saints' days on the calendar. First shows up being held on October 31st, somewhere around 1,200 years ago in Ireland and Northern England. And by 835 CE, November 1st officially became All Hallows' Day in the Frankish Empire of Charlemagne. There is general belief that the customs associated with the evening before All Hallows' Day were borrowed from pagan practices, including lighting lamps for the dead and dressing up in the costumes of martyred saints that night. The lights were known as soul lights, and people walked around with them, a custom known as souling, referred to by Shakespeare in the late 1500s. Apparently, sometimes those lights were placed not into lanterns, but in hollowed-out turnips, which, when imported into the New World, that custom led to the jack-o'-lantern pumpkins we have today. There's also evidence Halloween borrowed customs from the Gaelic festival of Samhain, a night when the portal gates to the underworld of the dead were thought to be opened, and whose practices included burning bonfires, drinking, feasting, bobbing for apples, as well as souling, but also mumming and guising, going from house to house, performing in exchange for treats or food or money. There never seems to have been what we would call a true religious centrality to Halloween exactly, however it was constituted. And in America, of course, Halloween became a night of costume children walking house to house, trick-or-treating their way to large sacks of candy doled out by adults to doorbell ringers. Often, of course, kids dress in costumes mimicking the deadly focus of the original holiday: skeletons, witches, ghosts, goblins, and the like. So, what is there that's Jewish about all this? Well, essentially nothing. I mean, it's kind of like Purim, which has costumes and revelry with lots more noisemaking, of course, and cookies, that is Hamantash, and in place of all the candies. Still, Halloween's not very Jewish. And you know, I've heard rabbis rail bitterly against Jewish kids celebrating Halloween, complaining that it's both pagan and Christian in origin and has nothing to do with being a good Jew today. And while that's true, I think it's also the case that there really isn't much harm in kids dressing up and going trick-or-treating, well, except the harm done to the health of their teeth. My own parents took us trick-or-treating when we were kids. I'm pretty sure they trick-or-treated themselves a bit when they were young. When I was little, we had a family hand-me-down pumpkin costume, a well-made fabric one passed orangely from child to childhood in my own family. I was greatly relieved when my younger brother got old enough to wear it and I could finally graduate to being a cowboy. Okay, so Halloween's not the most Jewish of American holidays. That would be Thanksgiving, coming up less than 4 weeks now. But it's really okay to let kids celebrate Halloween, as long as you don't let them eat all the Butterfingers and Milky Way bars the very night they bring them home. You know, we have a lot of great Jewish holidays. Hanukkah is now just 4 weeks away, starting tonight, 4 weeks from now. And celebrating an innocuous, non-Jewish one like Halloween isn't exactly going to ruin anybody's Jewish identity. But do make sure they brush their teeth tonight. play us in this morning on a holiday theme. Here's the start of our pre-Chanukah preview, my father's own setting of the Chanukah psalm, Pitachta, performed by a really good junior high school madrigal group from La Mesa, surprisingly well. Pitachta for Chanukah coming up 4 weeks from tonight. 8 nights of light and joy. Don't miss our own Beit Simcha Celebrate 3 event on the 7th night of Chanukah, December 5th in person. Go to our website, www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson, to find out how you can register. When we come back on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Rachel Beanland, author of Florence Adler Swims Forever, tells us how her own upbringing influenced her excellent novel set in Atlantic City before World War II, and why it's the right book for our time now. Find out and come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely but in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and or Saturday morning. You can join us Friday night also on our Facebook page, Shabbat Evening Celebration Services, both in person and on Facebook, are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat Morning Services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. We will hold our services with full music by virtual experience and in person, of course. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are both live and on Zoom in blended format. You can access those. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, or go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and Torah Tykes programs are available in blended format as well, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tykes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook Live, go to beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rachel Beamland is the author of Florence Adler Swims Forever, a beautiful and, even painful book about a lost world in many ways. Rachel Beamland is a graduate of the University of South Carolina in Columbia, I think. I was in Spartanburg for years. Earned her MFA in creative writing from Virginia Commonwealth and lives in Richmond, Virginia. But this is her first novel, and it's a gorgeous effort. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thanks for having me.
So to some of us, Atlantic City is just a bunch of names on a Monopoly board. How did you become so familiar with it?
So my grandparents grew up in Atlantic City, and by the time that I was born, they had moved away and, you know, they ended up retiring elsewhere. But I always heard amazing stories about Atlantic City and about what it was like to grow up there. And there was one story, of course, that, as you know, if you read the book, that was at the heart of a lot of the stories that I was told when I was young.
And was that about a woman trying to swim the English Channel by any chance?
Yeah, it was.
Funny. How did I know that?
I know. Interesting, right? My great-great-aunt was training to swim the English Channel when she drowned off the coast of Atlantic City, off States Avenue, actually. And when that happened in 1929, my grandmother was a little girl. She was on the beach that day. She witnessed her drowning. And the family decided, and really the decision was kind of spearheaded by my great-great-grandmother, decided to keep the news of this great-great-aunt's death. Her name was Florence. Keep the news of Florence's death a secret from my great-grandmother, who was in the hospital on bed rest. She had lost a baby the previous summer, and she was pregnant again. And you know, the family deemed it would be too risky to tell her this news. So I always grew up knowing the story, you know, that I had this young woman in my family who had drowned, that she'd been training to swim the English Channel, and that all of this had happened, you know, in this kind of magical setting of Atlantic City.
That's a crazy idea to us today. Obviously pregnancies were even more challenging in those days. The implications of that and the reverberations of that run all through the book. Did this feel a little bit, I mean, how much of this is revelation? How much of this is creation?
You know, I had this story at the base of it. You know, I knew there had been this family story, and I'd always been fascinated in the story. I'd been fascinated by the story, not only because, you know, this poor girl had died, but because the women in my family had really become fascinated with the story over the years. They held it up as a model of what to do, you know, if you really loved someone. They were very enthralled with the idea that my great-great-grandmother had been able to, you know, bury one child and then walk into another child's hospital room and act like everything was fine. And that decision, the women in my family kind of universally applauded. They thought she had done the right thing. And so when I was growing up and hearing the story, I questioned that. You know, I wasn't sure that it was so cut and dry. and that really became the the little kernel that made me want to write the book. You know, I saw the ways that even many, many years later, you know, my family was still kind of using the decision of my great-great-grandmother as inspiration for other things that we kept secret in the family, you know, out of, you know, never a desire for kind of personal benefit, always out of a desire to protect someone, to, you know, because you think you know best what would be good for them. And so that was really what I became so interested in. The book, you know, what I had at the heart of the book, this story of this drowning and the family's decision to keep the secret, was really just a kernel, like that, you know, that what I knew, what my grandmother had told me was very little. I was able to do some research and able to fill in some holes in the story. But ultimately, I had to create a work of complete fiction.
We will talk much more with Rachel Beanland about her beautiful book about refugees and Florence Adler Swims Forever. When we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America. According to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Malta this whole month. Really interesting little place in the Mediterranean. It was a place of Jewish settlement in ancient times, and then it became an important place in part because of some very interesting immigrants to Malta. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Right. There was one sort of a nutcase who proclaimed himself the Messiah in the 16th century named Abulafia, and he settled on Comino. Am I wrong about the century?
You might be wrong about the century, but you're not wrong about Abulafia.
Well, he settled on Comino. Actually, it must have been before the 16th century.
I think it's the 14th. 1492. 13th or 14th century.
Actually. 14th, right. That sounds more correct. Because in 1492, the Jews were thrown out of Malta and he wouldn't have been able to settle.
13th century, believe it or not, Abulafia.
Okay, yeah. So 13th century.
Yeah, there we go.
So he settled on Comino, which today has no settlements, no urbanization at all. After wandering through the Mediterranean world extensively,
he was in taught Rome, and had students in Sicily, in
Palermo,
in
Messina, all kinds of places. Okay. So he was a mystic, and like so many other mystics, Shabtai Tzvi notably, declared himself a messiah. He led a very interesting life and left behind at least two great works of Jewish scholarship. One was Sefer Ha'ot, which means the book of the letter, and the other was Imre Shefer, which is like words of beauty.
Or the divine flow or something. Shefer, yeah.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. So today, nobody lives on Comino. There's a hotel there, and it's beautiful because of its isolation and because there's no motorized vehicles. It's very quiet. It's surrounded by sea. It's a short ferry ride from either Malta or Comino, although...
Or Gozo.
Gozo. Yeah. But actually, you can't go directly from Comino to Gozo. You have to go back to Malta, south, and then you go north. I mean, that's a typical Maltese thing. There must be some interesting story of political corruption behind that.
I'm sure.
As there is behind most things there. But anyway, back to the 15th century when the Jews either went into hiding or left Malta.
Because of the Spanish.
Or they were in these prisons being held as captives for ransom. Jews kind of languished and didn't really exist outside of prison in Malta for the 16th, 17th, and much of the 18th centuries, almost 300 years. So there really isn't a continuous Jewish life on Malta to speak of because of this big interruption. What ended that interruption, miraculously, was Napoleon stopping to conquer Malta on his way to Egypt.
Yeah.
Okay, so on his way to one of his most famous conquests, he captured Malta for France, extended to everybody French citizenship, which meant equal rights for Jews. Jews were overjoyed and either came out of hiding or returned from abroad. And then, barely 2 years later, Malta fell to the Brits, and the Brits maintained those same rights. So starting in 1798 or 1800, Jews really started flourishing, and there was an influx of British Jews. Now most British Jews there are like retirees, people on pension, who come to enjoy the warm weather year-round.
Yeah, right. Of course.
But in those days, there were like normal British Jews and French Jews and Jews from throughout the Mediterranean world, and they're eventually, by the middle of the 19th century, there was such a sizable community that they decided they needed a chief rabbi, and they brought one from Libya, whose family name was Tayar. And I don't know this for a fact, but when I was living on Malta in the 1980s, the head of the Jewish community was a guy named George Tayar, who was very personable and who was born and raised on Malta and might well be a descendant of that chief rabbi from the middle of the 19th century. George and his wife Gita, and they had a lovely daughter, and they were pillars of the Jewish community. The Israeli chargé d'affaires, my direct colleague, was the victim of an assassination attempt while I was there. So the Israelis really beefed up security, and there was quite a little security community attached to the Israeli embassy, which hosted services for all the major holidays, like the high holidays and Pesach and all those things, were not held in the historic synagogue, which has since been renovated. There's also now a very nice Chabad house and kosher restaurant. That's all new. In the 1980s, the services we had were held in the Israeli embassy.
Good story, Tom. Fascinating place. Thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sarah says, I noticed you haven't been playing golf lately. You used to love it. Morris answers, I've got no one to play golf with anymore. Sarah says, what about our neighbor Max? He likes playing golf. Morris says, would you play with somebody who moves the ball when he thinks you're not looking and lies about his score? Sarah says, absolutely not. Morris says, well, neither would Max. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Toldot includes the treachery of Jacob and the foolishness of Esau. famous story of brotherly rivalry that sets in motion this central tale of Genesis. It's a story of twins who are anything but fraternal in their interactions. Jacob is a lover of tents, a homebody whose mother loves him. Esau is a hunter and outdoorsman, a man active in the extreme and more or less devoid of thought. In our weekly portion, Jacob fools his family twice. First, he cons the hungry Esau into selling his birthright, his inheritance, for a bowl of lentil porridge. Then, at the instigation of his mother Rebekah, Jacob fools his father Isaac into giving him the principal blessing, the spiritual heritage of the leadership of the people who will someday come to be known as Israel. Why is it that Jacob is the one who becomes the true father of our people? Yes, he is clever and verbal, cerebral, but he clearly lacks basic moral qualities that we should find critical. But Esau, too, is no bargain. All physical exertion and emotional outburst, instinctive but unreflective, all id to Jacob's superego. In fact, it's through both of them that the great story of God's oneness is carried forward. Through both of them, for all their flaws, God finds a way to work for the future and for our destiny. The message is complicated but useful. The truth is that we are all both Jacob and Esau, partly thoughtful, partly instinctive. We, each of us, are also twins in this sense. We can act with deliberation and care, or forcefully and without judgment. And we all have the capacity to be either ethical or unethical. In that dichotomy lies our innate humanity. And in the persons of Esau and Jacob, we can see ourselves and learn that it's only through God's providence that we will truly find our own promised land. When we come back, our guest, Rachel Beanland, explores what immigration to the U.S. meant in the setting of her novel and what role, well, competitive swimming plays too, and much more. When we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
It was an interesting article this past week on the JTA website, which lightly covers Jewish news all across the world. JTA stands for its full name, Jewish Telegraphic Association, which was how news used to be shared when it was founded over a century ago, back in 1917. JTA is pretty broad in its coverage. Its articles tend to be short and usually fairly uncontroversial. It's a good place to go to get general information on what's going on in Israel among U.S. Jews, European Jews, other communities ranging from Australia to South Africa to India. It's not the place to go for in-depth reporting about challenging topics, typically, nor is it known for investigative reporting, but it provides a valuable, if bland, version of what's happening right now around the Jewish world. I was surprised this week, therefore, to see a story in the most recent edition highlighting the fact that Chabad purchased about $137 million in real estate in the U.S. during the recent pandemic. First, it was surprising that JTA got to look at Chabad's famously secretive books. Second, it was a bit shocking to see that at a time when Jewish synagogues and other charities have been struggling to make a go of it in these extremely challenging times, JTA was publicizing Chabad's quite robust financial resources. It brought to mind a question asked recently in our own Jewish community here in Tucson, Arizona. If Chabad shlichim, there are many rabbis out there, have to raise their own salaries, which are supposedly fairly modest, how are they able to afford such expensive real estate for their own homes, and certainly for their synagogues, even in our mildly costly community neighborhoods? The nearly $140 million Chabad spent on real estate included properties in Lakeview on the north side of Chicago, in Greenwich, Connecticut, in Durham, North Carolina, and at the Champaign-Urbana campus of the University of Illinois. but it apparently does not include a variety of other real estate projects Chabad rabbis are engaged in around the country. According to a Chabad spokesman, Rabbi Moti Seligson, the real number is actually much higher, probably a multiple of that $140 million. And so, during a period when nearly all American Jewish institutions are hurting because of COVID-19, just where do all the Chabad millions of real estate money come from? And where does the money come from to support all the Chabad rabbis and their wives and their many children, who are often sent off to expensive yeshivas in other cities? And then there's the money to fly Chabad shlichim all around the country and to Israel on a regular basis. Chabad spends a great deal of energy on public relations and a lot of money on it, too. It has one of the greatest social media presences in the Jewish world, shows up first in many web searches on Judaism, runs well-financed websites, uses technology extensively, creatively, and often before other Jewish organizations even start. Chabad produces elaborate educational and outreach curricula, not necessarily good ones in a Jewish way, you understand, not scholarly ones really, but very splashy ones, and it circulates them everywhere Chabad is found, which is more or less everywhere. Chabad has logistical abilities other Jewish organizations don't dream of and can't compete with. Running giant kosher Passover seders for Israelis everywhere from Cuzco to Kathmandu to Kenya. Hosting Shabbat dinners every single week from Moscow to Marrakesh to Manila and not charging for them. Placing Chabad rabbis in Chabad houses on every American college campus with any Jewish undergraduate population at all. And the question is, who finances all of this? It has always been a bit of a mystery. It's certainly true that Chabad Shlichim, the name for their rabbi representatives, are all trained fundraisers, prepared first and maybe foremost in the skills of development professionals and given the materials to use for that, while most other rabbis, like me, learn these abilities along the way almost as an afterthought, and many never get very good at it. And it is certainly true that by its very nature, Chabad welcomes everybody. But so do most non-Chabad synagogues, at least officially. I think it's legitimate to wonder, where does all the money they employ to further their Chabad movement come from? And how do they manage to buy so much extremely expensive real estate and then renovate it expensively? In other news, the highest court in Greece ruled against allowing ritual slaughter, shechita, fulfilling fears that Jewish leaders have voiced over the last year after the European Union's top court ruled in support of these bans. Last December, the EU's highest court upheld the bans imposed in regions of Belgium against slaughtering animals for meat without stunning them first. This ruling meant that slaughter, in accordance with Jewish law, which requires animals to be conscious when their necks are quickly cut, would be prohibited in those regions, as it is in a variety of other parts of Europe now. Greece's top court did not cite that ruling in its decision last week on a petition filed by the Pan-Hellenic Animal Welfare and Environmental Federation, but Jewish watchdogs who have been monitoring bans on ritual slaughter across the European continent said the connection is undeniable. We warned last December about the downstream consequences that the European Court of Justice ruling carried, and now we see the outcome, said Rabbi Menachem Margolin, chairman of the European Jewish Association. Jewish freedom of religion is under direct attack. It started in Belgium, moved to Poland and Cyprus, and now it is Greece's turn. In 2011, the Netherlands briefly joined several EU countries where ritual slaughter is illegal. Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Estonia, and Slovenia among them. The Dutch Senate reversed the ban in 2012, citing freedom of worship. Poland outlawed the practice in 2013, but has since scaled back the ban to include only meat for export. The bans on kosher slaughter, shechita, are part of a struggle across Europe between animal welfare activists and Muslim and Jewish community representatives. In recent years, anti-immigration activists and politicians unhappy about the migration of Muslims in Europe have joined the debate. A similar fight is unfolding around non-medical circumcision of boys, that is, Brit Milah, in Jewish tradition. The Greek court said there should be ways to meet the demands of animal rights advocates and the needs of Jews and Muslims who follow the laws about food in our traditions. The government should regulate the issue of slaughtering animals in the context of worship in such a way as to ensure both the protection of animals from any inconvenience during slaughter and the religious freedom of religious Muslims and Jews living in Greece, the court said. But the increasing pressure against observant Jewish life in the European Union is undeniable.
Mut dit ball spieler, es passt nit as men verspiel. Weil sie seh, zwei, drei Steigs neus bei der Baseballspiel.
There are three prominent Jewish players in the World Series this year. That may be a record. Alex Bregman is the Houston Astros star third baseman. Max Fried is one of the Atlanta Braves' top starters. And Jock Peterson is one of their slugging outfielders. All three were bar mitzvahed, Peterson and Fried in California, Bregman in Albuquerque. Back in 2017, Bregman's Astros played Peterson's team then, the Los Angeles Dodgers, in the World Series. So they're going against one another again, but in a slightly different setting. This is Fried's first World Series. There have, of course, been Jewish World Series stars before, most notably Sandy Koufax, most valuable player of the 1963 and 1965 World Series, and an all-time Jewish hero for sitting out the opening World Series game, Yom Kippur 1965. Hank Greenberg, another Hall of Famer, was a World Series hero in the 30s and 40s before they had that MVP award, by the way. And back in the 1959 World Series, Sandy Koufax's teammate, pitcher Larry Sherry, was the most valuable player for his hometown Dodgers. Larry Sherry and his brother Norm Sherry both went to Fairfax High School in a very Jewish neighborhood of L.A. back then. They were teammates on the Dodgers of the late 50s and early 60s. For the record, Max Fried, who grew up a left-handed pitcher in Los Angeles, says Sandy Koufax, of course, was his idol. This baseball postseason, Jock Peterson has popularized the wearing of an old Jewish lady-style string of pearls, like your bubby wore once, on the baseball diamond during games. But the best Jewish story about these guys relates to Alex Bregman, who was featured as a baseball star in a Sports Illustrated story around the 2017 World Series. It included Bregman's bar mitzvah photo from Temple Albert in Albuquerque, New Mexico. A photo that showed my friend, Rabbi Joe Black, then the rabbi there, standing with the then 13-year-old Alex Bregman on the bima, both smiling in their tallises. I texted a shot of that Sports Illustrated photo to Rabbi Joe Black, an old friend and a past guest of Two Jewish, with a note saying, "I never thought I'd see you in Sports Illustrated." Joe responded back, "I taught Bregman everything he knows about Judaism." We wish all the Jewish stars well in this fall classic, this year being played long after any potential conflict with High Holy Day services. And finally, Mort Saul, the acerbic political comedian whose greatest success came back in John F. Kennedy's presidency, died last week at the ripe old age of 94. Mort Saul was born to Jewish parents in Montreal, grew up in L.A., and struggled to find success before gaining comedy fame in San Francisco at the famed Hungry Eye Comedy Club in the 1950s and early 60s. He was cited as a major influence by Woody Allen and Lenny Bruce, among others. Originally a favorite of many politicians, JFK asked him to write jokes for his campaign for president, Ronald Reagan was a close friend of Mort Saul. Saul later turned his barbs on those politicians. Mort Saul was the first comedian to win a Grammy for a comedy record. 2003, he received the 5th annual Alan King Award in American Jewish Humor from the National Foundation for Jewish Culture. Mort Saul was a political humorist who improvised his routines from the daily newspaper and was willing to tackle any political subject.
And as you know, there's a big scuffle going on in this state now about capital punishment. Largely, oddly enough, the religious groups want capital punishment, believing you must pay for the error of your ways, even if a man is occasionally executed unjustly. And they believe in that. Even though they made a very large mistake once.
Mort Saul was an important influence on the whole comedy profession. May he rest in peace. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rachel Beanland. She's the author of the beautiful novel Florence Adler Swims Forever, a National Jewish Book Award winner. A fascinating novel about secrets, really, above all else. Tell us about the refugee aspect of the story and how that plays into the whole theme of your novel.
I have a character in the book named Anna. And she is a young woman about Florence's age who comes over to the United States and specifically is staying in Atlantic City because the Adler family has sponsored her, you know, her immigration. She comes over on a student visa. She was a really helpful character for me and one that, you know, I knew I wanted in the book early on. Because she acts in many ways as a foil to Florence Adler, who is a young woman we've lost early in the book. I'm not giving much away to say that she dies.
You are not.
So Anna's really pivotal for a lot of reasons. She's a person outside of the family who can kind of look in and see the family and see, you know, what they're going through from a bit of an outsider's perspective. But she's also a Jewish girl who has come over from Germany and we're in the year 1934 in the book. She kind of came to me in part because I had heard stories in my family about, this is really on my grandfather's side of the family, not my grandmother's, but both sides were in Atlantic City and they had brought over some cousins before the Holocaust. And there were some family stories surrounding that. And these were cousins they didn't know well, that they, you know, brought over and just kind of helped get on their feet. And so that was in the back of my mind as I was writing Florence Adler. And then once I started to do the research and just think a little bit more about what Anna's character might be like and you know, what she was and wasn't going to do on the page, I became really immersed in this research specifically about Jewish immigration from Germany in the years before the war. In the 30s, when things were getting worse, the Third Reich had come to power and people had reason to go, but of course nobody could foresee what was coming. And what I learned a big surprise to a lot of people, I think when they read the book is just how much of immigration at that time was being stymied, not by the German government, but by the United States, that there was, so much anti-Semitism within the State Department. We had quotas for Jewish immigrants that we weren't meeting each year. And that, you know, Jews who wanted to immigrate were getting so many mixed signals and you know, inconsistent answers when they would go to speak to, you know, members of the consulate in Germany. And so that was a little bit of what I wanted to document with Anna's character. You know, I was writing the book between 2016 and 2018. So immigration was, of course, very much on my mind. I mean, it continues to be in the headlines, but we've just had so many headlines in the last couple of years it has to share some space. But it was certainly something I was thinking a lot about as I was writing the book. And I think that as a Jew living, you know, in the United States, and, you know, I have an interesting heritage via my mother and my father. And it's something I'm always thinking about. My children are, two of my children are adopted internationally. And so, you know, I like to think of this country as a country where immigration is possible and, you know, can be a lifeline for people. But that wasn't always the case in the 30s.
Well, you know, a great deal of the tragedy of the book, the complexity, and a lot of the secrets come out through the discussion of, well, it springs from that immigration story. I guess I keep wanting to ask how much of that is really connected to your own family, how much of that came out of your mind?
From the immigration story, you mean specifically?
Yeah, specifically.
You know, I call Anna a composite character. She's based on these stories that I heard on my grandfather's side of the family. But on my grandfather's side of the family, the stories I heard about were men. So, you know, she's a young woman. She's come over to go to school. You know, for many reasons, it worked for her to be a woman in the book. But that is that's the family connection.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered as you wrote Florence Adler Swims Forever?
I think for me, the most surprising thing about writing the book was the sympathy that I ended up having for my great great grandmother's character, this woman who made the decision not to tell her daughter that her other daughter had died. You know, when I set out to write the book, I kind of came at it with my 21st century sensibilities. And I thought, you know, I'm really going to make the case for transparency. And I'm going to kind of prove the women in my family a little wrong in terms of the fact that, you know, I thought sometimes there are secrets that just can't be kept, right? And what I found, I wrote the book in rotating perspectives. So there are 7 points of view in the book, and we rotate through the characters 3 times. And that means that I had to write from the perspective of this grieving mother, you know, who had just lost a daughter, but was doing everything she could to save the other. And that was an interesting, you know, perspective. It was interesting to walk in her shoes. And what I found the more I did so, was I understood some of her grief and I understood her desperation. And, by the time I finished the book, I had a lot more sympathy for her. I'm frequently asked when I talk about the book, you know, what I would do in a situation like this, knowing what I know now. And of course I hope I'm never in such a situation. But it's not clear to me, you know, even after writing the book, writing the book allowed me to get so close with these characters and I, you know, I know what they would do in these situations, but I still am not 100% clear on what I would do.
The idea of keeping things from children, and particularly, you know, in this case, it's a child, but it's a grown child who's pregnant. That's not an unusual Jewish familial trait. Do you ever find yourself keeping things from your kids?
We're certainly much more transparent, but I think that probably a lot of that stems from the fact that I grew up with this story, and I grew up with the story being kind of the center of a lot of decision making in my family. And I think that there was a part of me that was kind of actively working against it. I can remember when my father got sick, he had pancreatic cancer and died about a decade ago. And I can remember my siblings and I, you know, talking to my parents and saying, you know, we really hope that you can be truthful with us about what's happening, because we felt like at the time, you know, we might make different decisions about how we spend our time, you know, in those last months, if we had a clear picture of what his health was like. And my parents were good about that. They, you know, made sure that we were along for the ride and understood what was happening for better or worse. And so I try to remember, you know, the times that I've had things kept from me and the times that I've enjoyed that level of transparency. And I do kind of, with my own children, try to work toward more transparency. But I see the ways that it comes up again and again. You know, there is an instinct to protect them and to protect my mother. And also, you know, in the case of my mother, I'm always asking, well, what would she want? You know, would she want to know this piece of information? And often the answer is no.
We never find out what Fanny thought about the death of her sister, or even how it affected her. How do you think she reacted?
In the real story, we don't know either, because the women in that generation, you know, Fanny was my great grandmother. Esther was my great great grandmother. They were very tight lipped. And so, you know, we do know that the two women went on to have, you know, a long relationship. There was no, outward, you know, bad blood. They continued to see each other, you know, on Friday nights and, you know, hang out at the beach and whatever it was they did, they continued to do those things. But my grandmother doesn't, and my grandmother did not remember any talk of Florence's drowning. It was a completely taboo subject. You know, I think the only reason I know about the story at all is the fact that my grandmother was a little girl that day and was witness to it. You know, I think had she not been witness to it, she wouldn't have even known what happened. So there wasn't a lot of chat about it. And as a result, we don't know how she reacted. I chose not to put a reaction in the book intentionally, because there was a little bit of a craft issue with it. You know, when you're writing, you don't like to tell readers the same information twice. And of course, for the parents to have to go and explain it to Fanny, they were going to need to retell her what had already happened in the book. So there was that issue, but also, you know, the times in my life when I've gotten truly terrible news, like the death of a young person that you're really not expecting, I feel like there's kind of only one way you do react to that. You know, and you're such a mess that, it felt like the wrong tone to end the book on. You know, it was so clear to me she was in for a really hard year. Or more, it didn't feel like the right place to end the book.
Now the worst question, you won the National Jewish Book Award for debut fiction. That's a pretty good way to start your novel career. What's next?
I'm working on another book. I'm working on a book that's actually set in Richmond, Virginia, where I live. It's historical fiction as well. We're going further back in time, but in 1811, there was a very bad theater fire in Richmond that took place that year. And I'm kind of following a number of people in the aftermath of the fire. It's another book about grief. And, you know, in this case, I'm looking at how a whole community is grieving as opposed to one family. So, you know, there are some elements that overlap. But yeah, people ask a lot, am I coming back to the Adler family? They want more of Atlantic City, more of the Adler family. And, you know, maybe at some point, but right now we're going to Richmond in the 1800s.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can't have a Netflix series if you don't have more books. I'm sorry.
Right.
Where can people go to find out more about you, Rachel?
My website's a great place to start, rachelbeanland.com. And you can also find me on Instagram at rachelbeanland. It's an unusual name, so you shouldn't have any problem tracking me down.
Definitely an unusual name. Thank you so much for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Jeremy Cowan, founder and president of Schmaltz Brewing Company, an old friend of Too Jewish and creator of Hebrew Beer on their 25th anniversary and their new ventures coming up, or at least his. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning to 9 a.m., Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush. And this Friday night, November 5th, we've got a delicious Shabbat dinner, chicken, and all kinds of other fixings at 5 p.m. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up. Our playout this morning comes from Adam Sandler, his original version of the Hanukkah song, now coming up in 4 weeks. That's still very likely the best of his various versions, silly and dated, but sweet and innocent back then. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Put on your yarmulke, here comes Hanukkah. So much funukkah to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we have 8 crazy nights. But when you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's a list of people who are Jewish, just like you and me.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.